Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Hi there, I'm Yom, host of Item 13, an African food podcast. I'm excited to be joining the Heritage Radio Network this year as we kick off our fourth season of the podcast. On Item 13, we cover all aspects of the African food ecosystem. You'll hear West Africans squabble over who has the best jollof. Newsflash, it's Ghana.
It's time to celebrate our jollof. Like, we are done with comparing who and who did what. Yeah. And jollof is not just about even the rice, it's about the protein that goes with it.
Guests share their expertise on African food ingredients and spices.
This is a region where, you know, even if you look at 18th century maps, you know, you had something called the Pepper Coast. Fresh and aromatic peppers. That is what distinguishes West Africa.
Tips on marketing food businesses.
A good way to engage your audience is to take them on that journey. You know, get them talking about this idea you have. That way you're engaging them, they're engaging with each other, and you're getting useful insights that you can then pull from and use to develop your recipe.
This season, my goal is to focus on more stories outside of English-speaking West Africa. So you'll hear stories from Benin, from Uganda, Liberia, and even Haiti. You will also hear us discuss the impact of the Black Lives Matter movement and how COVID-19 has impacted some of the businesses featured on the show. You can catch up now on previous episodes of Item 13, wherever you listen to podcasts, and join us this season as we debut on HRN. Thank you.
Good afternoon and welcome. This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, and we're going to have a really interesting discussion, like completely new to me. We will be speaking today with Dr. Jeff Anderson, who is a professor in the Michigan State University's Department of Geography, as well as being the state climatologist for the state of Michigan. He has professional experience with the National Weather Service and with the USDA's World Agricultural Outlook Board in Washington, D.C., where he was involved in international crop and weather impact assessments and production estimations. He currently serves as director of Michigan's EnviroWeather Information System, which supports agricultural pest and production management related decision making across the state. And you can find that website at enviro-weather.msu.edu. And as an extension specialist, he maintains an active outreach program, including dissemination of weather and climate data and information to the general public and continuing education activities. I'm sorry it's a long bio, but it's so worth telling you everything about this man because he is clearly such a rock star. Okay, teaching responsibilities include courses in agricultural climatology. You can see why I want to have this man on my show like basically every week. Meteorology, regional climatology, and physical geography. Primary focus of Anderson's research has been the influence of weather and climate on agriculture, both in the USA and in international production areas. Current and past themes include climatological trends and potential impacts, crop simulation modeling, agricultural irrigation, impacts associated with potential future changes in climate, weather, and risk management, and the influence of land use changes on regional climate. Welcome to the program, Jeff.
Well, thanks very much. Glad to be here.
Well, thank you so much. I mean, you know, I've been doing, I don't know if I mentioned this when we did that little piece on the derecho, but I have been doing this show for 10 years and it's never occurred to me, more than 10 years. And it's never occurred to me to go in search of a climatologist slash meteorologist slash, you know, expert on how those two disciplines affect agriculture, and yet you really are, you're kind of the gold, you're the golden goose, my man. I mean, you have the, you've got the real information. So let us start this interview with you telling us about your work and your, how you synthesize your work as a climate, as a geography professor and meteorologist with the discipline of agriculture.
Well, as you've outlined, my specialty discipline basically spans two major areas of science and agriculture, and then atmospheric science. And I think basically what I do, or what people like me do, is to realize that weather and climate are for most food production systems are key, if not dominating, external factors in terms of controlling almost all aspects.
Pretty much, yeah.
The idea is to try to come, to be able to make better decisions, to be able to design a more efficient, more sustainable food production system. And again, how weather and climate play into that, because they have such an important role. And it's never boring. I can definitely attest to that. There's that theme is, though, comes back over and over and over again. And most of my work is here in the Midwest, and now in the Great Lakes region, but I have worked in other parts of the world. And that these dependencies are different depending on where you go. But again, ultimately, most everything comes back, or many things come back, to a weather and climate angle. And again, the idea is to try to help improve that understanding between the dependency in the food production system, and hopefully with that to make a more efficient system, and to allow the producers to try and maybe make more informed and maybe better decisions regarding weather and climate.
Well, we could drill deep into what better decisions they could be making, but that is maybe for later in the program, if not a completely different interview. But let me ask you this: how do you interface with your agricultural community? I mean, obviously, the work you're doing on modeling climate and meteorological events is somehow pushed out to the agricultural community at large. Who is doing that? Who is doing that for you? How do you reach those people? Do they come to your website? Do they, you know, I mean, do you give lectures? I mean, what's the method?
Right. There's several pieces, or several layers, I get to that. That's that part of the how this works. But I work in a university in a state which is very, very diverse agriculturally. I believe, depending on how it's defined, either second or third largest number of crops produced commercially, which is a little surprising. But because of that, we have an awful lot going on in the agricultural sector, ranging from the traditional row crops like corn, soybeans, wheat, to specialty crops like tree fruit and blueberries and strawberries. We have a large greenhouse, glasshouse industry. So you name it. We have hops now for brewing and beer making. So it's very, very diverse, and all of these crops have different vulnerabilities and different links with weather. But in terms of the information flow, of course, research takes place on campus and at a number of different places around the state and around the region. We work with other collaborators in other states here as well. But the key factor here, I think, is that we have blessed to have a very, very strong extension system within the state of Michigan. Mm-hmm. And so the results and the, I guess, the whatever is gained in terms of knowledge, hopefully ultimately makes it back out to the real world. But it's a two-way street. And so that's a really important part of this, the way that this thing works is, yes, that research goes on here, and hopefully some of that flows back out to the real world where it can be used. But there also is a flow of information in the other direction. And a lot of that has to do with, well, what the needs, what the problems that are observed, what are the challenges that growers or what elements of the industry face. And so between in that two-way street, there's a lot of places to interact and to try to hopefully add some information. And so I also deal with directly one-on-one with people call and ask for something as simple as a request about climate that occurred, maybe 50 years ago, or how does this summer compare with last year? It varies. So it's a general outreach to the public, and that's part of my my appointment.
And what about the ERS, the Economic Research Services? Because they don't they model a lot of sort of what people are should plant and how much they should plant, and sort of help farmers predict markets. But surely they must also have to give farmers predictions about weather cycles or patterns. Do you also work within that group as well?
They do. Well, we certainly work in collaborative with it, in a larger sense with the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which ERS is a part of, and they have a very, very broad and diverse group of pieces and elements, each contributing, and so yes, we do work with them. They're also besides that, I mentioned other universities, which is also very common. There's also a large private commercial sector in the agriculture industry, where folks are doing their own research, collecting their own data, and trying to again answer or respond to some of the same questions and challenges. So it's a multifaceted effort. All in all, the university is one part of it.
You know, I mean, the thing that leaps out at me is that, I mean, when we're talking about sort of trying to explain to farmers what to predict or how climate is affecting their crops and what they decide to do, it's also true that what they do has this gross impact, I mean, almost oversized impact on how the climate is shifting. And that's something I want to get into with you. But you know, it's just the irony of that, or I don't even know if it's ironic. It's just like, you know, it's so intertwined. You know, the way we farm here has had these massive influences on climate change. And as I say, that may be another program. I don't know, maybe we'll get into it. But what I wanted to get into right now is, when you look at climate patterns of today versus 10 years ago or 5 years ago, what are the most striking changes that you see?
To me, and this again would probably be a little bit parochial thinking about where I am and located, but it would be, I think, be fairly representative for the upper Midwest, which is a big agricultural area in the United States, but it's getting wetter. And it's not just that it's getting wetter with more precipitation, but we're seeing more extreme events, especially on the higher end. And you mentioned irony, and this is somewhat ironic, because if we look at the major limitation, weather and climate related limitation for many of the food crops that are produced in this part of the world, either the lack of or the abundance of water is the number one factor in terms of describing that variation from year to year. So having water is a really, really important part. And it is for all of our global food production system. So having more water through precipitation, at least on the surface, is generally a positive thing. But of course, it's always more complicated than that. And you always have to be careful for what you ask, or the old adage says, be careful how much you ask for, because in many cases we see instances of too much water. And this is one example of that is we have seen a trend in the springs for a decrease in the number of days that field work can take place because of wetness in the spring. And we had the classic example of this occurred in 2019. When we had one of the wettest springs on record, and as a result of that, growers could not plant crops, at least not on time. There were major delays, and there was a record amount of area that wasn't planted just because it was never dry enough. That's something that hasn't happened before, but it is a direct reflection of the trend that I'm talking about here. And so you can have too much of a good thing, certainly. It does reduce risks in other parts of the production cycle. So that, for me personally, that would be on the top of my list. I suspect there would be others that would agree with that.
Well, that was my next question is, do you feel like the meteorological community is united in its thinking about weather patterns and climate disruption? Or do you feel like there are still elements of dissenting voices that challenge these views about how weather patterns relate to climate overall, meaning climate disruption or climate change or whatever you want to call it, global warming, it doesn't matter.
Well, at least in terms of the patterns that we're talking about right now, which are essentially observed changes or observed trends, I pretty much everybody would be on the same page. We're looking at the same base numbers. I think one can probably the interpretation and the impact, that could be another area. Well, we can maybe disagree with that, but I think most of these would all end up on the same.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I'm getting at. It's like, yes, everybody can see that the rain gauge is, 5 inches taller, yeah. Fuller this year than it was last year. But is everybody going to be saying, well, this is a result of, climate pattern disruption or change that is basically unprecedented, I guess is what I'm
right. Thinking. The attribution question is another part of this. If we look at in a bigger picture and we look at what's happened and what's projected, and I would say right off the bat that much of what has been projected for the long-term future, again, here in the Midwest, we have been observing. And I personally don't think that is completely coincidence. It gives us, I think, a little bit more confidence about these projections. But those projections do call for certainly a climate here significantly much warmer than has been the case historically, and depending on the time frame, maybe a little bit wetter in the shorter term here over the next couple decades, but ultimately possibly even a little bit drier. And we can talk more about that here in a bit. It depends on the time range how far out you're looking. But
how far out can you model?
That mostly this depends on the purpose and the need, but in general, many of these projections that we're talking about go out essentially about a century out, but through the current century. They to do this requires a great deal of computer resources and know how, and it's quite a demanding thing, and there are a few dozen groups around the world that have the resources and the wherewithal to do this, but thankfully they do. And it's done on a recurring basis as the science improves, and the ability to simulate climate, I think, is also improving. But generally, there are some research projects that go beyond that, but many of them essentially go out to about a century through the end of, or at least through the end of the current century, if not a little bit longer.
I don't think I want to know. I think I'm too scared to ask that question. But let's talk for a minute about the derecho, which is how you and I met. For listeners who are not, who have not yet heard this segment, but a few weeks ago, I interviewed Jeff and a few other folks in the Midwest, specifically in Iowa, about this horrendous storm, which I don't know if you realize this, Jeff, but it got almost no coverage whatsoever on the East Coast. I don't know if it made a lot of headlines in the Midwest, but it was very, very slow to get picked up by the news here. And I, in fact, learned about it only because I follow the trades. It was not reported in the Times or even or the Washington Post, for example, the two papers I follow, until a good 5 or 6 days had already elapsed. Anyway, the point is that we had this lovely conversation about the derecho, and I wanted to follow up with you about, extreme weather extremes that we are seeing, like the derecho. Now, at the time when I interviewed the people who were local in Iowa, they described it as literally a once in a lifetime event, or maybe more.
Right.
Well, was it or wasn't it? I mean, you sort of downplayed that a little bit when we talked. You're like, derechos happen, but nobody's ever heard of a derecho before this.
And they do. Derechos do occur. Thankfully, they're not. But one like this, I think the distinction here is the severity and the magnitude of this particular event is up at the, well, it's at up at the top of what would ever be experienced. And some of the survey teams from the National Weather Service that went out found evidence for winds of possibly on the order of 140 miles per hour, which is just something you don't very, very rarely see with straight line thunderstorm winds. And of course, as we talked about before, it occurred over a large area, which is what makes this so destructive.
Right.
And what makes it so important to try to understand or better understand. because it's not just a many times we see severe weather hit, but it hits areas severely, but they're limited, they're localized. In this event back in August, it was a large area with hundreds, thousands of square miles being impacted. And that's just something we don't see very often. The only thing like that I can think of meteorologically would be, again, a landfalling hurricane, where we see a relatively large area impacted by this one big event. But of course, we don't have hurricanes in the Midwest, or at least not the severe hurricanes, strong hurricanes. We sometimes get remnants here, but that's it. Mm-hmm. This derecho type of event, though, is something like that. And the other thing that occurred with this particular event, the strong winds or the severe winds with this lasted for an extended period of time. Many times a thunderstorm goes through and you'll only have the really high winds or the destructive winds only maybe for a minute or two, just for a relatively short time. This one lasted tens of minutes, which again is also very, very unusual. And one of the reasons why it was so destructive.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
They're still being written, and there will be papers written about this event. And as we've also mentioned, unfortunately, the damage, the total extent of the damage still is not clear. It's still being tabulated. So, but it will be economically, as you mentioned, where does it rank? We don't know, but it's up near the top. It's one of the largest severe weather events that's hit the Midwest in a long, long time.
Yeah. I mean, it was kind of like a Hurricane Sandy. It was like the equivalent of a Hurricane Sandy is how I see it, which was kind of from my point of view as an East Coast person, that was a once in a lifetime storm.
And
that was on the magnitude of the hurricane.
Right. And it also had major agricultural impacts. And again, it's hard to do that when you consider how large an area that you've got this food production system set up. But it was so big, the area impacted was huge relative to what we've observed in the past, and it's still being cleaned up. So very, very unusual, rare event to say that doesn't do it justice, but it certainly is in that extreme category.
Incredible. And so when you saw the appearance of this, because I think if people have been following in any case, the storm originated, I believe, in South Dakota, and it moved very rapidly, taking most of Iowa, you know, central Iowa and some other states, and it went as far as Ohio, if I'm not mistaken.
We actually had some in Michigan as well, but it was the process of weakening and dissipating. Mm-hmm. We had some damage in the southwestern part of our state. We were up on the northeastern fringe of the event, and it moved almost 800 miles in 7 or 8 hours, something like that. It's just extraordinary, a path that, again, that's something else we just don't see very often, an event like that.
Well, I think the governor described it as sort of a 75-mile-wide tornado that lasted for 40 minutes.
Right.
And I mean, I know that it was in Cedar Rapids for about 40 or 45 minutes, according to eyewitness reports there. But what I wanted to ask you about is when you saw that storm originating in South Dakota, you said to me, when we talked about this a few weeks ago, you said that you had actually had a fairly good amount of sort of lead time or warning time in which you could alert people that this was happening. How did you map its progress? How could you, I mean, could you tell what path it was going to take?
That's a really, really important aspect of this because we have to give credit where credit's due, and that goes to the National Weather Service. Mm-hmm. Storm Prediction Center as a part of the National Weather Service, but they had warned and had tried to raise awareness that day earlier on that there was the potential for an event like this. And it was the guidance was very, very close to what actually happened. I don't think anybody would ever have envisioned it was as large and severe as it was, but the guidance that morning, the wording was very, very good. It was an excellent forecast.
And wow!
Like in this case, again, they verified well. So certainly, there was awareness there, and at least through the National Weather Service and through the public channels, they tried to increase the awareness of the risk of this type of an event. And then, again, it lasted over a long period of time.
Right.
but they did. They did a very, very good job. And there was even a hint of it, a couple of days in advance. But that the day of, I thought they did just an amazing job. And it shows you how far the science has come, I think. It's a good example for illustration of it doesn't mean it's going to happen every time, but that was a particularly a good one, at least in my book.
Really interesting. Okay. So we're going to take a short break for a sponsor drop. We'll be right back with Professor or Dr. Jeff Andresen from Michigan State University, state climatologist and professor of geography. We're going to talk more about climate and agriculture, because really without a hospitable climate, folks, there's going to be some very serious food shortages. Anyway, stay tuned. We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's, the pizza restaurant, is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. And of course, there's the 2 Michelin-starred Blanca tucked away in the garden for truly daring diners. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City and now in Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, speaking about climate and agriculture with my guest, Dr. Jeff Andresen from Michigan State University. So one of the other things I wanted to ask about the West Coast, of course, is being, eaten alive by wildfires. And of course, last winter, Australia also similarly suffered massive and destructive wildfires. How much do wildfires, like when you see these, horrible apocalyptic landscapes of, smoke and ash and orange and, recognize that the sun is being blotted out. What impact does that have on weather to come and also climate change in general?
Well, I think there's a couple pieces in there that are really important to remember. And one of them is a little, well, it's one we don't think about very often, but that relates back to the fact that as the air warms up, it can hold more water vapor. And that sounds like a strange thing to say, but it's very, very important for this whole issue, because the warmer the air temperatures are, at least more potential water can evaporate. And what we are seeing here, and many of these and places that you've mentioned, certainly the Western U.S. and in Australia as well, is we're seeing increases in temperature. The climate is warming up. And as it warms up, there is more potential evaporation taking place, and we're looking at essentially at a drier landscape. We also, in some cases, we've got issues with a lot of fuel out there, downed trees or diseased trees or trees that have died. There's a number of factors, but at the top of the list, though, is the warmer temperature. You just have a greater demand, more evaporation, and you increase the risk for fire to take place. And in many of these events now, though they're so large, they have their own heat source. They create their own circulation, literally a natural firestorm, and that's part of the difficulty with fighting these types of events. So they're given the size, but it is ultimately related to the fact that the landscape has dried out, or dried out more than it typically does in the past, and that's part of the climate link, and that's why we hear people talk about, well, this being a sign of a changing climate, and it's just a drier landscape than used to be the case.
Even if it's wetter in Michigan.
Yeah, and of course, I mean, well, and that's a good point. It does vary by region, but One of the interesting things is even here in a place that is getting wetter, some of the projections as we look especially out several decades, they also suggest that even if more precipitation falls, it might fall on fewer days and become more erratic. And as it becomes more erratic, you could actually, the statement, sometimes it's confusing. And I spent a lot of time with this one. Some of our climate assessments talk about a climate here in this part of the world that we have both more heavy flooding rain events and more droughts. And most people look at that and they say, well, that doesn't make any sense. And most on the surface, it doesn't. But there is one physical way that that could happen. And it's relating to what we're talking about. And that is that, yes, we have more precipitation, but it's concentrated in a few events in extremes that can cause flooding. But in between those events, we tend to have more strings of dry days. And so you're looking at an increase in the variability of the especially the hydrologic system, the mm-hmm. water, excess, both excess and deficits increase. And that's, unless you sell irrigation equipment, I can't think of anybody who benefits from that situation. That it, when precipitation becomes more erratic, it's much, much more difficult to deal with it, adapt to it, cope with it, however you want to call that. But extremes are much more complicated than adjusting or shifting your practices to long-term changes in the mean. Ah. And that's one of the things that we face here in this region and are looking at now with research.
Well, that is exactly, you have just set me up perfectly for my next question, because as a meteorologist and a professor of geography, you know, when you think about the future, what kind of agricultural model or measures would have the most success in mitigating climate change and climate disaster? Like,
right. That's going to depend, of course, and it always, this is a terrible cop-out response, but it really is going to depend okay. on the ag system and where you are. Mm-hmm. But as we think here about the Midwest, this is actually going to be an area, especially where we are here in the upper Midwest, one could certainly see some benefits. One of the benefits we see right now with recent changes, we have almost 2 weeks longer frost-free growing season than we did just 40 years ago. That's a big change. And yeah. that lack of growing season or growing season length, I guess I should say, and it being a bit short, that's a limitation on our food production system. But it's getting longer as the climate warms up and it gets wetter. We also have we've had less droughts. We still have droughts, but they're less frequent and they're less severe than they used to be. At least that's the observed trend. That could change in the future. But as you look at how to design this, this is actually already happening. Our growers are growing cultivars and varieties which can take advantage of the longer season, and as a result of that, they can have higher productivity, at least potentially have higher productivity. So that's one direct physical influence. We add on top of that increasing concentrations of carbon dioxide, which of course is the primary greenhouse gas, but plants can take advantage of that. That's at least another mitigating factor, that should help many types of crops. But there are also a whole list of potential problems. One of them that we're looking at now, that's an interesting one. It's somewhat of an indirect impact, but that's the pest complex. And mm-hmm. of course, we think about producing these crops, and if you go out and you look at the pictures, you say, "Wow, the grower's done a fantastic job. There's no weeds, or you can't see any insects." But of course, that's not how the real world works. It takes a lot of work to do that. And so if a soybean plant is happier with a warmer and wetter climate with more carbon dioxide, well, so would probably many weed species, or maybe certain insects, and especially insects that have not been here before, that because of climatic reasons, and they've been allowed to migrate from other places into the region because of climate. The winters are no longer cold enough to knock them out in the cold season. There's a number of it's almost like an ecology. They are ecological factors here, mm-hmm. but this is one that relatively little is known about, but is still very, very important. And that is, how do we control weeds, insects, and diseases in this changing climate. Not an easy thing to do, and a lot needs to be learned. One particular, I think, back to the direct physical factors, a big concern is that we know that many of our food crops right now in some parts of the world, they are currently being grown in areas near their maximum temperature before the plant begins to lose productivity. Mm-hmm. And this is especially true at night. And one of the things that we observe in parts of the U.S., especially in the southern parts of the U.S., when we have very, very abnormally warm nights, and we see a large number of those during the growing season, we'll actually see a decline in crop productivity. And what it's probably pointing at is that there's a physiological limitation for some of these crops like corn and soybeans. And if you raise the temperature beyond that limit, you just begin to lose productivity. And so our agro technology industry sector, the folks who come up with new varieties, et cetera, that's a really, really big need. It's a huge request, but somehow we're going to probably have to come up with maybe at least aim to come up with some crop varieties that do better with not just with, they have them to deal with drought and with the lack of water, that crops that do relatively better with less water. But we're also going to have to figure out that temperature, because that's also one of the scenarios that there's a lot more confidence in. Almost much of the world, the vast majority of the world is warming up, and some of our production areas around the world warming up more than others. And once you get to those limits, though, you've just got a barrier or a wall. Mm-hmm. And so it's going to be a particularly tough one to deal with. There's obviously a lot of money investment and interest in that now, but it's a difficult one.
It is. I mean, you're just setting me up every single time for. You're so good at this, Jeff. So what do you see for America's agricultural map? So especially like the corn and soy belt. So if we're reaching the point where never mind the soil quality and the water pollution and everything that goes along with massive corn and soy production. But if they are reaching the edge of their productivity due to climate, to warming weather trends, do you see the Corn Belt moving farther north into Canada, and we're going to start growing rice and cotton in Michigan? You know what I mean?
Well,
like,
this,
how much change this isn't, do you see happening in the agricultural map?
It's a very, 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 very good question, an important one. And there's a couple thoughts on that. But yes, in general, if these projections continue to play out and are accurate, is looking at the next few decades, there likely would be a northward shift, at least in terms, and we have to put quotation marks around this, because it's not so easy just to pick up. You can't pick up the Corn Belt and shift it northward. There are a number of reasons for that. You mentioned one of them, and the soils take thousands of years to form. And one of the reasons the Corn Belt is the Corn Belt, and it is one of the most productive areas on Earth, is because of the soils that are there. And you can't, again, you can't just pick up these areas and move them. The other is, of course, you have to have infrastructure in food production systems to be able to take advantage of the production from the landscape. And that just doesn't happen overnight either. But the big one is, I think, it's the soil. And one interesting, I guess, reminder about this is we are already seeing this happen. If you look at the statistics, and if you do any traveling out in the especially in the high plains or in the parts of the Great Plains in the upper Midwest, there has been a very, very real and distinctive shift of the Corn Belt to the north and west over the last couple decades into places like North Dakota, South Dakota, that 20 or 30 years ago produced different crops. Now there are economic reasons for that happening, but there also are climatic reasons. Their corn is produced now for grain in places like southern Manitoba in Canada. And that also, again, 20 years ago did not happen. The technology is better. We have better varieties that can make, but again, some of that is climate. So we're already seeing some of that happen. And those are areas, though, that do have the soil resource to do this. But I think that's actually one of the most important factors, is that you have to have the soil resource there if that's to take place. But if, again, overall, if these projections are accurate, or they're at least in the close, there would be a northward shift, or areas there would be a loss of some types of agriculture across southern portions of the U.S. with the shift northward.
And, well, you mentioned soils, and I'm gonna go off on a tangent. I warned you. Oh, I do this.
Yes. You probably want to, why is that?
I actually do know the answer. I do. I have actually done quite a few programs around soil and soil chemistry and the need to, you know, change our methods of agriculture, whether it's, you know, adding cover crops or no-till,
yes,
or, you know, all of that, yes, stuff to help, because we are actually fundamentally, we have essentially stripped a good portion of the famous Midwestern, you know, prairie soil, either through runoff from, you know, disastrous flooding, because they don't cover the crop, the land in the winter. So when it storms in the winter, a lot of that water, you know, or snow runoff takes away the soil. So we've experienced a big loss of topsoil in those areas, largely through our practices of monocropping and just using the same two crops over and over again. And so, you know, so I'm wondering, like, you know, aside from climate change, we're facing having to change up those areas just because the soil that you're talking about is ceasing to exist in many of those places, or not existing to the extent that it is. And part of what's driving climate change is that very fact that we are not sequestering enough carbon through our crop processes and so forth. So how do you, you know, wean us off of that diet of corn and soy into something that's more regenerative, that would, you know, mitigate some of the climate impacts?
Well, this is an excellent point. And actually one of the most critical ones, I think, for the long-term future. And again, the word that some people complain it's used too much, but it is. We have to, it's sustainability.
Yeah.
And that is, that soil is a resource. And as you mentioned, given the last 120, 30 odd years, depending on the location, the science hasn't been there. And some of that resource has unfortunately been lost. We can't afford that. So, so you think about the challenge ahead of us. We've got to feed a world with a growing population. That's another huge challenge, and hopefully try to minimize the number of hungry people around the world. But we have to do it without destroying the resource that enables us to produce it. And that's,
well, I don't feel like the problem is that we don't grow enough food. I think we grow way too much food, to be honest.
Yeah,
we waste the food
we do. No, that's true.
50% of the food that we grow in this country winds up in landfill. So, I mean, I the whole sort of feed the world thing, you and I can have another discussion about that. I don't buy into that mega agribusiness mythology of how the United States alone is supposed to somehow carry the weight of the world's, you know, future hungry on its shoulders.
Nobody can do that. I mean, that isn't fair.
It's not even a real problem at this point. People are hungry because of distribution, because there's economic inequalities. I mean, they're not hungry because we don't have the food, or we won't have the food even. We unfortunately have to rush along here because sadly I do have to call this quits myself in about 5 minutes, and I have so much more to talk to. You're going to come back, Jeff. I hope you know that.
Okay.
Because really, this is so good. This is like so interesting. And whoever talks to a climatologist or a meteorologist about agriculture, I feel like I should get a Pulitzer Prize for this show. Anyway,
thank you for that. I'm glad there are a lot of you have a lot of options here. I can refer you to there are a lot of people, but no, it's great to get this
in the same place, you know. So as you mentioned before, agribusinesses are working really overtime to hybridize and change up models of commodity crops like corn and soy, so they can control for, you know, more or less water and, you know, more greater or less weather extremes. So how do you predict that those new, hypothesized new crops, how will they affect land use? Are they going to, you know, is it just, we're just going to do more of the same, do you think? Or, you know, what is going to happen? They're going to
have that's actually, it's already changing. And, the industry is already adjusting to some of these new realities, these new recent trends.
Yeah.
And will be more in the future. Of course, the challenge is going to be how can it, and these folks are in business. So of course they're there to earn a living and have to be sustainable economically as well. So they're going to have to continually be looking for new opportunities as that climate in the background shifts or changes. Some ways it and not favorable. So it's a tough thing to do. I think given that combination of players that I talked about before, they're at least there's some awareness of what people can do, but there are going to very likely going to have to be changes. I think diversification probably will be an important part of this. And you also mentioned too, the soil health part of this is becoming more and more important. The awareness and the realization about that resource and trying to maintain the productivity, but also the health of the soil is going to be a very, very high, high demand or high need of some. That needs to take place more than it probably ever has in the past. And so again, collectively, hopefully we're aimed in the right direction to try to take on some of this challenge.
Now, do you see that, here I go again on another tangent, but do you see that happening within your own university? I mean, you mentioned that you have a very robust extension school system in Michigan. Right. So there's a lot of smart people thinking about, you know, crop change and soil health and so on. Do you see within the university context more of an emphasis on maintaining productivity, on growing soil health? You know, because I mean, back in the day, you know, 25, 30 years ago, it was just like, oh, throw some more phosphorus and nitrogen on there. And,
right.
You know, like, no, keep it rolling, you know?
Absolutely. No, there is a much more holistic type of view and a realization, I think, again, when we have to look at this, it goes back to, again, to the ecology and we just can't afford to not sustainably manage these systems, and I think, and that starts with the growers, but it's also certainly in the industry, the research community. All I think there's very, very strong shared belief in that has to be a major need or a major requirement for
right.
how the system works, and I think it does bode certainly better, more positively for the future. We just can't do anything without that soil resource.
That's right. Absolutely. Unfortunately, I'm going to jump to our last question here. But we are going to talk in the future. You're going to come back and we're going to talk about vertical farming and urban agriculture, just because I think that would be a fun topic to discuss in the context of what we've been talking about in terms of how crops are going to have to move around in this country and how things are going to be changing in the coming decades. You know, like what role do you think? But anyway, we're not going to talk about that now. We're going to talk about this, which is, what advice would you have to offer the agricultural community about how they should be planning for the coming decades? Like, how can your information help farmers recognize some of the imperatives that they need to absorb in order to continue to farm successfully?
You know, that's a really tough one. And unfortunately, there aren't a whole lot of really easy answers to this, because it's a big challenge. It's a tough problem. But that said, if there were one thing, and it's more of a philosophical thing, but I think we have to become more dynamic in terms of how we plan and how we look at least for the near future, because we are, in essence, we're shooting at a moving target. Mm-hmm. And many of the planning systems that we've used in the past assume stationarity or something like it, and it just, the system just isn't like that. So the better able we are to make adjustments or make changes to our system, and the more economically we can do that, the better off we're going to be. That's much easier said than done, of course. Yeah. But I think there's going to have to be, we really have to shoot for that. I think being nimble is the old word, that to be able to not only to observe, to understand the new trend and its impacts, but then to adjust your own system accordingly. To be able to do that is going to be more and more important, I think.
That is the holy grail, isn't it? We have reached the end of this particular program. Jeff, I can't thank you enough for being on this show. I feel absolutely thrilled to have met you virtually. And I will be putting you in my roster of regular voices because you are so smart and so well-informed. And this was just a terrific discussion. I thank you so, so much for joining me today. Is there any place where people can follow information that you may have, or are you too modest to have a website or...
don't really have a, well, you had mentioned our EnviroWeather site. That's one mm-hmm. rule. But, in all honesty, most of what, we deal with and talk about comes through our Michigan State University Extension.
Okay.
And there, that's usually where most of it gets out to the general public either. And nowadays, a lot of that, would be either live, webinars or recorded. A lot of it's now, both visual and so there are more options now than there used to be.
I'm sure there are. Thank you so much for joining me today. And thank you my sponsor and to my wonderful engineer, Jess. We'll see you next week. Thanks for listening, folks. I appreciate your time. Bye-bye for now.
What Doesn't Kill You is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. Food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.